Syria strongly condemns France's colonial-era policies, saying diplomatic stances adopted by Paris are detached from reality. Russia says use of U.S.-made military hardware in an attack on its border region proves growing role of the West in the Ukraine war. And U.S. stocks take a tumble for a second day as negotiations aimed at heading off a looming government debt default remain deadlocked. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Syria has strongly condemned France's policy toward Damascus as hysteria, saying the diplomatic stances adopted by Paris are detached from reality. Syrian Foreign Ministry also accused Paris of seeking to restore its colonial past legacy, said in a world which is based on multipolar system, it is not possible to dominate other nations as France did during its colonial era. Ministry added the new world system requires respect for other countries' sovereignty. Now, this after the French foreign minister called for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to be put on trial. Catherine Colonna's remarks came after Assad's landmark participation at the Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia upon the kingdom's invitation. Syria was suspended from the bloc following outbreak of foreign-backed militancy in the country in 2011. May 25th marks the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon. In the year 2000, Israeli troops were forced to withdraw unconditionally after Lebanese resistance inflicted heavy losses on them. Our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, has your details.
On May 24th of the year 2000, Lebanese masses flocked to their hometowns and villages in a surprise move that shocked the Israeli army and sent the Israeli collaborators fleeing towards northern occupied Palestine.
Towns witnessed over 18 years of Israeli occupation, terrorism, killing and destruction. Thanks to the strategy of attrition adopted by the resistance movement, the Israeli army was left with no option but to withdraw unconditionally from the land it had occupied.
Since then, Lebanon has celebrated May 25th as a national day of resistance and liberation.
We earned our freedom. It wasn't like they said, oh, we left. No, they didn't left. We make them leave.
Hassan was forced to leave his hometown during the Israeli occupation. He recalls how terrorized he was as a child when the Israelis first invaded South Lebanon.
I was forced to leave my land in 1982. And I was unable to come back until after 2000. It was a great moment. I can tell the difference, like when we used to drive or when we was kids. My parents used to say, don't look, don't smile, don't do nothing, don't breathe even. That's how much we were scared.
Today he brings his son to see the fruit of years of struggle.
After hard work and all the suffering that the army of Hezbollah went through, and fought hard and freed the South Lebanon, Junub. And now I can hear with my friends, five of them, all from Canada. They wanted to get a good vacation. We didn't know where to go. And I asked my dad, and he's like, Lebanon, you have to go to Lebanon. Now it's free, beautiful country.
Of course, it shows the strength, of course, of the community and how you can't take something that, you know, rightfully belongs to someone. And honestly, just overall, it's been beautiful so far here, and it just really shows how much love there is in the city.
After, you know, withdrawal in 2000, you can see the smile in the face of the people, especially the children. They can, and they can play, and they can walk around in peace, and they are really happy to go to come back to their homeland, which we really paid a lot of blood to get it back. And we are looking forward, really, for the Palestinians to live and to have the same feeling as we feel.
The fruit of liberation is seen by the people of Lebanon as a natural outcome of resistance, and they have voiced their support and encouragement to the Palestinian people that someday they too will be free. Mariam Saleh, Odaisi, South Lebanon.
Moscow has strongly condemned the use of U.S.-made military hardware in a recent raid on a Russian border region by pro-Ukrainian forces, Kremlin says the development proves growing involvement of the West in the Ukraine war. Now, the Kremlin spokesman said West is delivering more military equipment to Ukraine to be used against Russian forces. Dmitry Peskov added this issue proves that Western countries have a direct and indirect role in the conflict and is growing by the day. He said Russia is pursuing these developments and is drawing the appropriate conclusions. His remarks came after the Russian Defense Ministry issued a stern warning over an attack on a border area, pledging an extremely harsh response.
On May 22nd, a unit of the Ukrainian Nationalist Formation invaded the territory of the Russian Federation in the area of the international checkpoint in the Belgrade region. In the course of the counter-terrorist operation, the Nationalist Formations were blocked and defeated by airstrikes, artillery fire, and the active actions of the Western military district units covering the state border. The remaining Nationalists were driven back to the territory of Ukraine, where they were completely eliminated. More than 70 Ukrainian terrorists were eliminated, as well as machinery and armored vehicles. We will continue to respond promptly and harshly to such actions by Ukrainian militants.
Shoigu described the move as an act of terrorism by Ukraine against Russian civilians. Kiev, however, has denied any involvement in this assault, which has been claimed by two anti-Kremlin far-right armed groups. White House spokesman John Kirby has reacted to the incident, saying that Washington does not support the use of U.S.-made equipment for attacks inside of Russia. He added that U.S. is looking into reports that its military vehicles were used in the cross-border attack. The Russian President Vladimir Putin slams Western countries for trying to impose dominance and rules on other nations. He said they're doing this at the cost of completely ignoring the sovereignty of other states. Addressing a conference on security, Putin warned the world is becoming increasingly unstable and new centers of tension are emerging. He added the situation is being accompanied by a buildup of military potential and unceremonious interference in the internal affairs of countries. Putin said there are also attempts to extract unilateral advantages from energy and food crises provoked by a number of Western states. Now, elsewhere, Putin said that Russia isn't to blame for energy shortages in Europe as it met its commitments on energy supplies to the continent.
Our opponents have said a lot about the energy crisis in Europe, but I want to remind you again, whose fault is that? Yes, there was a crisis. Now, thank God, energy prices are closer to economically justified. But whose fault is that? Nord Stream 1 was blown up. Nord Stream 2 has not been opened. Poland has closed the Yamal-Yura pipeline. Did we shut it down? They did. There are two gas pipelines through Ukraine. Ukraine has closed one of them. We did not do that. By the way, we used the second line to supply gas to Europe and Ukraine despite calling us an aggressor. Successfully cashes in on the transit. We are fulfilling all our obligations completely.
Putin mentioned Nord Stream 1 and 2 in reference to pipelines that were used to move Russian gas to Germany through the Baltic Sea. Now they were severely damaged by explosions last September. Russia says U.S. was behind the blast. Now investigators from Sweden and Denmark said that ruptures were a result of sabotage without saying who was responsible. NATO says Ukraine will not be able to join the Western military alliance as long as ongoing war with Russia rages on. NATO chief said the alliance's main priority is to ensure that Ukraine prevails as a sovereign independent state. He added, if Ukraine does not prevail, then where would there would be no membership issue to discuss. Solberg said the alliance's next summit will focus on increasing the interoperability of weapons and systems between Ukraine and NATO. Ukraine officially applied for NATO membership in September. Moscow has repeatedly warned against Ukraine's NATO accession. It says preventing Kiev from joining the Western alliance remains one of the main objectives of its special military operation. U.S. stocks have taken a tumble for a second day as negotiations that seek to head off a looming government debt default remain in a deadlock. Now on Wednesday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average slid 0.8%, the S&P fell 0.7%, while the NASDAQ Composite drop 0.6 percentage points. Now this, as talks continue between the White House and House of Representatives to raise the government's borrowing limit. President Joe Biden has offered to freeze government spending at current levels. Now that move will reduce the government's deficit by over $1 trillion. The White House has criticized Republicans, saying that averting default is responsibility of Congress and preventing it is not a concession. The U.S. is in for a crippling default as early as June 1st if Congress does not lift the debt ceiling. A default to leave millions of Americans without paychecks. It could also trigger a recession, destroying millions of jobs and businesses. Members of the Asian Clearing Union, the ACU, have gathered in Tehran for their 51st summit to discuss how to make more profits from alternative currencies as the dollar is gradually losing its global appeal. We discussed this issue earlier with our guests in our news review program. Here's a playback.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Top banking officials of the Asian Clearing Union, known as the ACU, are in Tehran to explore new strategies to raise profit and to advance the de-dollarization campaign. Governor of the Central Bank of Pakistan, Jamila Ahmad, as a former chairman, said the union can come up with new ideas for alternative currencies that would bring more benefits. He hailed developments in banking relations and the creation of a non-SWIFT messaging system. Governor of the Iranian Central Bank, Mohammad Reza Farzin, for his part, voiced Iran's readiness to help facilitate financial banking exchanges between member states. Iran holds the rotating presidency of the nine-member union, which was established back in the year 1974 with the aim of reducing dependence on global currencies, especially the U.S. dollar. One main objective of the ACU is to facilitate payments among member countries for eligible transactions. Yusumish Ahmadi is a correspondent who joins us here in the studio. She was at the event, so she has a lot to tell us. We also have Peter Koenig. He's a former World Bank economist joining us from Lima, Peru. All right, welcome to you both. Peter Koenig, all you hear about these days, in a sense, at a more accelerated pace, I don't know if you agree or not, is the fact that you have this de-dollarization motion that is spreading rather quickly. It's been in the news, but didn't happen. It was intermittent in terms of the way that it happened. But now you hear it almost all the time. You have this particular event that took place here in the Islamic Republic with this ACU. And, of course, the de-dollarization drive is there amongst the member states. No surprise that Iran is obviously all for that. Explain to us why it is that we're looking at a rapid acceleration when it comes to de-dollarization, in a sense, and whether it's going to happen as quickly as many say that it's going to happen.
Yes, thank you for having me. I first of all, I would like to say also that it is actually amazing that this Asian Clearing Unit, I think it's a terrific idea, created in 1974, has actually gone very much under the radar up to now. And now it comes to the fore, and it's the right moment, and it's a good moment. Now to the de-dollarization. I would like to say two things. First, to the de-dollarization, and then something about the ACU, which I think is a brilliant idea to stretch out and to enlarge. First, the de-dollarization. If we look at the value of the dollar in trade and particularly in reserve currency back in the 1990s, it made up for probably 90 or more percent of all the reserve currencies, the reserve currency denominated assets as the US dollar. Now it has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk again, and I think it was in 2021, it was about 57% of all the reserve currencies, and in 2022, it sunk below the crucial border of 50% and is now around 45%. That shows how the world is de-dollarizing. This means, of course, primarily the East, for good reasons, but also many Western countries are trying to diversify their reserves for other currencies. So this move by the Asian Clearing Union to become a full-fledged, non-SWIFT trading money transfer platform is an excellent idea. Now, what I would like to add to this, and I think this is, I'm sure it's not a new idea. If possible, more and more countries with perhaps even stronger currencies that the current nine countries should perhaps join in, if possible. And that will be, of course, China, Russia, and all the BRICS, perhaps also as partner with a partner agreement with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to make it a really full-fledged transfer partner.
Sure. Gisu, you, I think, mentioned prior to the broadcast that there was a special guest that was present there in the non-observer status or observer status, arrangement. Tell us more about that and the significance there.
That is absolutely right, Kaveh, and your guest from Peru also mentioned something very important, the currency basket. You know that this is a two-day summit, so it will continue tomorrow as well behind closed doors, and very important issues are on the agenda to be discussed. One of them is the currency basket that was just mentioned. Also, quite surprisingly, this ACU is up to date when it comes to banking technology, because another thing on the agenda is the feasibility of using digital currencies in order to make banking transactions. This is also another issue that is going to be discussed behind closed doors. But another issue, maybe more important than any of the issues that we just mentioned, is adding new members to the ACU. This is one of the things that was being discussed today. The statute will have to be revised in order for new member states to be allowed into the union. And today we had three very important guests who were there as observers. There was Russia, the governor of the Russian Central Bank. We also had the governor of the Belarus Central Bank, and also from Afghanistan. And these are observer states that are planning to join the ACU. And you know that if Russia is in this mix, it will totally change the equations of this union and what it will be able to do in the future. It will bring about great potential, which of course already exists there, but it will definitely make the ACU more effective in moving away from the dollar.
We appreciate it, Peter Koenig, former World Bank economist from Lima, Peru, and Gisu Misha-Ahmedi, a correspondent here in the studios. Thank you for stopping by. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
Britain is now paying the price for its decision to leave the European Union. Guy Hans, British financier and chairman of the private equity firm Terra Firma, says Britain will soon be poorer than Poland. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Bloomberg wrote in this regard, Brexit has weakened the UK economy and driven the nation into a sort of geriatric decline. British financier and chairman of the private equity firm Terra Firma told Bloomberg recently. Since the UK left the European Union, it has been competing on the world stage, but the country's current laws are not suitable for the new environment. Billionaire Guy Hans suggested in the outlet's weekly In the Cities podcast, unless change happens, the UK risks becoming poorer compared to other European countries. He said, I look at the UK and see that in 2030, Poland will be wealthier than we are. In 2040, we will be the poor man in Europe. According to Hans, the UK should not have left the EU, as the country needs rule of law and consistency. But not a single politician is talking about going back. He lamented that Brexit has essentially thrown the country back 50 years to the 1970s, a decade that is widely remembered as a time of crisis. With a skyrocketing inflation, high unemployment, strikes and power cuts, the enormous amount of political change that has happened in the UK over the past 7 years has left investors concerned and the public lacking confidence, the billionaires believe. Now that the UK is out of the EU, the British government could take a radical approach and change some of its laws, Hans said, citing the country's extraordinarily complex labour laws that are a nightmare compared to other European countries. The UK also needs some boring bookkeeping, and the current Prime Minister Rishi Sunak seems to be good at it, according to Hans. The financier noted that the British government has succeeded in repairing some of the damage caused by Liz Truss, whose economic policies are absolutely disastrous and would have led to the country needing a bailout. Truss' argument, however, that the UK needed to become much more productive to be more competitive was 100% right. The Atlantic also wrote in this regard, if you walked into a British supermarket this past winter, you were likely to see bare shelves in the salad aisle. Customers might have been limited to purchasing lettuce and tomatoes if there were any lettuce or tomatoes to be found in the first place. Ask the grocers and you'd hear technical explanations for the scarcity, high energy prices, raised costs at British greenhouses. Imports from warmer countries were curtailed by bad weather in southern Europe. Behind all of these situational explanations, however, loomed a larger problem. From the time a tomato is harvested, every minute counts en route to the purchaser's table. In March, British media reported that Britain's departure from the European Union has added 10 to 20 minutes of additional paperwork to every truckload of tomatoes shipped from Spain. Longer if the truckload mixes different produce varieties. 10 to 20 minutes may not sound like much, But multiply that burden by thousands of trucks, squeeze the trucks through the bottleneck of the single underwater tunnel that connects Britain to freight traffic from Europe, and costs and delays accumulate. The result: winter tomato gluts on the continent, winter tomato shortages in the UK. British consumers are spending less on new clothes and shoes than they did in 2018 and 2019. The British are holding on to their cars longer. The average age of vehicles on British roads have reached 8.7 years on record. The British made about 2 million fewer trips abroad in 2022 than they did in 2018 and 2019, an almost 20% decline. Lingering COVID concerns after a partial explanation, but the UK and most of its European Union neighbours had dropped most travel restrictions in January 2022 and the remainder by March. Altogether, Britain is expected to be the worst performing of the world's 20 biggest economies this year. The British government's official forecaster predicts that after inflation, household incomes will decline by an average of 7.1% over the 3 years ending in spring 2024. On the present trajectory, Britain will not return to 2019 levels of disposable income until 2027. By 2024, the average British household will likely have a lower living standard than the average household in Slovenia. On present trends, the average British household will be poorer than the average in Poland in 2030. Britain is now paying the price for its decision to leave the European Union. Britain voted to exit in the summer of 2016. The departure was formalized on December 31st, 2020. Since then, new barriers of trade, investment and movement have risen between Britain and its nearest neighbours. Investment in Britain has tumbled and the British economy has shrunk. By one authoritative estimate, Britain is 4% poorer today than if it had stayed in the EU. Many in the British government are reluctant to acknowledge this reality. Hugh Peel, the Bank of England's chief economist, lamented in a recent podcast interview, "What we are facing now is that reluctance to accept that, yes, we are all worse off." These costs don't necessarily make Brexit a mistake. Brexit was a trade. Less prosperity for more sovereignty. Countries reasonably make such trades all the time. The British were not honestly alerted to the cost of their choice. In 2016, future Prime Minister Boris Johnson campaigned for Brexit in a big red bus carrying a huge printed message, "We sent the EU £350 million on a week." The British war promised that Brexit mean more resources for public and private consumption. Instead, Brexit has predictably turned out to mean less, and the British are surprised, baffled, and of course angry.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear ladies, welcome to a new episode of Muslim Lady. Well, this is IRB English Radio. I am Asma, playing your host for today, and Sister Zainab is here with me. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam, and assalamu alaikum to you and your listeners.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Well, previously we talked about different factors related to a woman getting into a job. And it's actually a longer story that we've been through. We said that when she is going to get into a job, for whatever reason, at the very first step, she has to consider many things, like the consent of her guardians, like the balance that she's going to make between her family and her job, and also the dignity. She must be considering her own dignity and her own characteristics in the jobs that she's going to take. Number two was family and job. And I guess that has got a lot to say. If you are a single woman, I guess it's pretty much easier for you to handle that because you're not going to have too much of responsibilities at home, or at least they are not much enough to make you restricted in the job that you're doing. But if you are a mother and if you're a married woman, then the story gets too much of twists, you know? It's going to be pretty much difficult for you to make the balance between your family, the time you put for your family, and your responsibilities that you have there, and also the time that you're going to devote to your job. And this really is a big question. How is she going to handle that, and what challenges she's going to face?
Yes, when it comes to being a wife or being a mother and at the same time you're a career-driven woman, you are often overwhelmed, unprepared, or you would at most of the times find yourself on the crossroads.
Yeah.
There are so many challenges, but I'll just refer to some of them that you as a mother or as a wife face while being in the work field at the same time.
Well, just for the record, so that the audience would be clear, in this part, I would say that she also is a perfect mother who is handling too much of jobs at the same time. So I guess whatever you're going to tell us today is going to mean a lot because it comes out of experience.
Yeah, I do have had the experience of all that, and I know why you're asking me that. Anyways, the biggest challenge is to find a balance between work and family. It becomes more challenging if you are having young children and at the same time you're working. Now this balance is like the biggest challenge you can ever face in your life.
Exactly.
And the challenge becomes even more difficult if you have more working hours. You know, extra working hours and the young children for a mother and for a wife.
And all the cooking and all the schooling and everything.
All the chores of life.
And then you have your husband to be taken care of.
Exactly. It really becomes difficult to find a balance. The first challenge that you face with is to maintain that balance between work and your family, especially if your children are younger and if your workload is heavier. Then is to deal with the guilt. Deal with the guilt of like you feel guilt about not being able to be with the family all the time. You do have this guilt that maybe I'm not a good mother.
Yes.
Maybe I'm not a good wife. Or if you are a good mother and a good wife, you have this guilt. Maybe I'm not a good worker.
Yes, exactly. And in some situations, if something happens to some of your family members, then you would say, I was not taking care of them enough. That's why all these problems happened.
Exactly. So, you know, this is one of the challenges that a mother or a wife faces or deals within herself. Or maybe she does not.
Mental pressure, you know.
Yeah, she definitely deals with this guilt. So I had this guilt for the first time as a mother when I had to keep my son in the kindergarten. And I was not able to focus on anything else. I found the story of a woman very, very similar to that of mine. It was an article in The Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Where she was saying, like, stop fooling yourself that you can be a good mother at the same time as a good worker.
How honest she is.
Yeah, she literally wrote, this was a dialogue, that article, like, stop fooling yourselves. Because she said, like, and see, she's saying that it was my dream to get into the foreign policy. And at one point of time, when I was a mother, and my kids were as good as, like, her son was 14 years old, the elder one. And then she gets a job in the State Department. And she says that that was a dream job. And then we had some inauguration function, and, you know, everyone who was newly appointed, they were in the jobs, and there was President of the United States, his First Lady, yeah. and everyone was around. There was party, champagne, and everything. And when everyone was around, happy and giggling around, I was disturbed about my 14-year-old son who was at home, who had recently just got back from this bad habit of skipping homework. Now he was recently getting back to the doing tasks at time and all, and my all attention was there. She says she faced another woman who had a similar experience over there, who was a working woman and had children. She was talking about her experience with her, and she said that she also has the same feelings, you know. So why I give this example over here, like working in such a place where president comes himself and
yeah.
so from a so-called superpower
like
country.
Like what people see is a prestigious job.
Yeah. And she was having this guilt, like, I'm not a good mother.
Yeah.
And she was saying, and she completely confessed that, stop.
Now, that's really a big question. I would like to ask all the mother out there who are as well working outside the home. Do you think that you are devoting enough of time to your children as much as you are devoting time to your job? Do you think you're a good mother or you're a good worker? Which one is it? Or can you just make a balance between that?
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Yes, welcome back. This is Muslim Lady. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I am Asma, and Sister Zainab in here is talking about the challenges that a mother would face as she go for a job.
We talked about that she finds it hard to make a balance between the work and the family. And then there's this emotional guilt
yeah.
that she feels within. And it's very hard to cope up with this guilt that when mm-hmm. she feels like maybe I'm not giving enough time to my family. Maybe I'm not giving enough time to my workplace. Maybe I'm not giving enough time to my husband.
So, and most probably, maybe I am not giving time to myself as well.
Exactly. Well, women are is an epitome of life who distributes love, and she
yeah.
mostly they less care about themselves.
She's the engine yes, of the family.
She mostly cares about others than herself, but that's not again wise, because as long as she's not fine, nothing else is going to be fine. So
yeah, that's very true.
She has this guilt, you know, and it's very hard to actually cope up with this girl. Then she definitely has a struggle to find a quality childcare. Like if she now decided to go for a job and there's no way that she quits it, or she does not have an option to go for more maternity leaves or another kind of leaves, she finds it struggling to go for an affordable, for a convenient childcare where she can put her child, or to find an affordable nurse who can actually take care of her child, or sometimes many other struggles that she faces as a wife. Then there's discrimination from the families or relatives. Like, you know, many working mothers are not considered to be good mothers.
Yeah. Now, that, you know, I always think about this that, okay, when the story started, from the beginning, when women were only mothers at home and they were trying to be a good wife and they were perfect mothers, spending too much of time with their children, I guess things were pretty much more beautiful. And the women were more satisfied with their life, I suppose. Right now, maybe they have more of money, maybe they have more facilities, maybe they travel too much of places, maybe they bring too much of their wishes into reality. But the thing is that deep down, as you just talked about it, they did not feel okay, because there's this guilt that would kill them from the inside.
That does. Well, that does. I do have the experience of that. Yeah. Although I was failing with this guilt when I was trying to continue my studies. I was trying to go into more other fields. But then I asked myself, I could not live with this guilt. I just left everything. I left my studies or all kinds of works I had at least for 2 years when my children needed me the most, because yeah. I just calculated whatever the amount of knowledge I'm going to get outside. Maybe I'm going to get the beautiful experience of my life,
yeah.
which, because my son is not going to remain of this age. when I'm done with my studies. This age is not going to come back, so I have to,
yeah, you know. And they would never forget that. You know, I had friends. Well, my mother is a housewife. So I had this privilege that I had my mother every time when we were at home. But my other classmates, when they talked to me about their experiences and their situations at home, they said, when we get home after the school, we are alone until the night comes. And then at night, our parents come home and they both are tired. So we eat food and then we go to sleep.
It's a lack of quality time.
Yeah, as if the house is just a dorm and it's a place just for sleep.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this is really excruciating. So I guess before we get into some more, it's a perfect time to go for a short break. Welcome back. Well, this is the last part of today's episode. Let's see what Sister Zainab is going to add to whatever we're talking about.
So we're talking about the challenges a woman faces as a mother or as a wife. We said she has this emotional
breakdown, let's say, too much of guilt. There is another important factor that I would love you to talk about it very briefly, which is this mental pressure. Just as the guilt you talked about, it's going to have too much of pressure on her. It's going to cause too much of breakdowns inside her brain.
See, the challenges, all these challenges that a woman faces, like having inconvenient time, getting frequent calls, be that from workplace or when she's at workplace, getting frequent calls from home, your child is not fine, your husband needs something. And
all the time you think you're on fire.
Exactly. And it becomes so much challenging for her to be focused at particular place. All these challenges drain her emotionally, not only emotionally,
and energy,
her physically.
Of course, yeah.
This is actually having a great impact on her physical health, on her mental health. Sam has not made it obligatory for you, you know, to be facing all these challenges, to be actually draining yourself physically, emotionally.
That's why in Islam, the man is the one who's responsible to provide the family with food and money and whatsoever.
Exactly. Provide her with shelter, clothes and food.
According to her dignity, of course.
Exactly. It's the basic requirement of a family is to be fulfilled by man, not woman. So woman is not, it's not obligatory for her. But yeah, if she wants to be a helping hand, there's no issue. There's no issue in it. But she has to make sure that she makes a balance. Like she does not have difficulty in choices, like, you know, sorting priorities. Sorting priorities is, even for the best time managers, it's one of the biggest, you know, difficult tasks ever. That a woman has to sort priorities. Shall I give time to my family right now, or shall I give time to my husband or my children? And we previously learned it beautifully from Lady Zahra Salaamu Alayha. When she had to manage time between her children and husband, she would play with her children, praising their father in front of him. You know, that was actually kind of a tricky way, or a very wise way, I will say,
of taking care of both at the same time.
Both at the same time. And so we have to be wise. Like, we can't be able to divide our time and doing all the things at the same time. Sometimes wise things help, and Islamic teachings have a lot to say.
Exactly, yeah. So I guess there's still a lot to talk about in this realm, and there are too much of aspects that we would have talked about, but we're running out of time. So, take care of yourself and do not overload yourself with too much of pressure, whether it be a job or anything else, because I guess the family matters most, and your health, your mental health, is the most important thing in this world. So take care of yourself. Thank you for staying with us until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting. Waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
According to an opinion poll released recently, concerns over gun violence epidemic and the prospect of losing their homes have increasingly weighed on young Americans. U.S. Democrats and gun safety activists have argued that passing stricter laws would reduce gun violence in the United States, whereas Republicans and gun rights advocates are saying that arming people would act as a deterrent. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has covered this story and tells us more. A new study has revealed that about half of young Americans feel unsafe amid concerns over gun violence and homelessness, with a quarter of them having thoughts that they would be better off dead. An opinion poll conducted by the Institute of Politics at Harvard Kennedy School showed that 48% of Americans aged between 18 and 29 have felt unsafe in the past month, with 40% worried about falling victim to gun violence and 32% concerned that they could become homeless one day. In the spring of 2023 edition of the Harvard Youth Poll, which was conducted between 13th and 22nd of March, 2,069 people between the ages of 18 and 29 were surveyed. The 45th edition of the poll also indicated that over 3 in 5, or 63%, of young Americans support stricter gun laws. According to a non-profit research group, more than 12,800 people in the United States have died from gun violence so far this year, which means an average of over 114 deaths per day. The latest report by Gun Violence Archive says there have been 168 mass shooting incidents so far this year, and that the number of mass shootings has gone up significantly in recent years. According to the poll, U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating dropped from 39% last fall to 36% due to the worsening figures associated with violence across America. The survey also found that 47% of Americans under the age of 30 report feeling down, depressed, or hopeless, and 24% have had thoughts that they would be better off dead or have considered self-harm at least several days in the last 2 weeks. Seti Warren, director of the Institute of Politics, IOP, said the data collected in this opinion poll clearly demonstrates not only the growing level of political engagement among young people, but the urgency of addressing serious issues such as mental health, gun violence, housing and more. Ethan Jasny, a 25-year-old student chair of the Harvard Public Opinion Project, said, "From fears of mass shootings to concerns of one day becoming homeless, the current state of Generation Z could perhaps best be summarized in one word, anxious." Generation Z refers to a generation that was born between 1997 and 2012. Ethan Jasny said, "Young Americans have translated this fear into action, turning out to vote like their rights and lives depend on it. But we cannot take this engagement for granted. Public figures across the political divide must recognize the profound personal challenges that members of my generation face every day." The Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. The U.S. is setting a record pace for mass killings in 2023, replaying the horror on a loop roughly once a week so far this year. The carnage has taken 88 lives in 17 mass killings over 111 days. Each time, the killers wielded firearms. Only 2009 was marked by as many such tragedies in the same period of time. Children at a Nashville, Tennessee grade school gunned down on an ordinary day recently. Farm workers in Northern California sprayed with bullets over a workplace grudge. Attendees at a venue outside Los Angeles, California massacred as they celebrated the Lunar New Year. Recently, 4 partygoers were slain and 32 injured in Dadeville, Alabama, when bullets rained down on a Sweet 16 celebration. And a man just released from prison fatally shot 4 people, including his parents, in Bordeaux, Maine, before opening fire on motorists traveling on a busy interstate highway. The bloodshed represents just a fraction of the fatal violence that occurs in the United States annually. According to an analysis of the Associated Press USA Today data, yet mass killings are happening with staggering frequency this year, an average of once every 6.5 days. The 2023 numbers stand out even more when they are compared to the tally for full year totals since data was collected. The U.S. recorded 30 or fewer mass killings in more than half of the years in the database. So to be at 17, less than a third of the way through, is remarkable. From coast to coast, the violence is sparked by a range of motives. Murders, suicides and domestic violence, gang retaliation, school shootings and workplace vendettas all have taken the lives of 4 or more people at once since 1st of January this year. Yet the violence continues and barriers to change remain. The likelihood of Congress reinstating a ban on semi-automatic rifles appears far off, and the U.S. Supreme Court last year set new standards for reviewing the nation's gun laws, calling into question firearms restrictions across the country. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this story. Academic studies have shown that 1/5 of American households bought guns during the coronavirus pandemic, according to an analysis by the Trace, a non-profit, non-partisan news organization that tracks gun violence in the United States. U.S. citizens purchased nearly 60 million guns between 2020 and 2022. All the new weapons have fueled a momentous surge in gun deaths, which reached record highs during the same period. Demand for firearms had been growing throughout the coronavirus outbreak. California, New York, Washington, Alabama, and Ohio were a few states, among others, that were reporting firearm sales growth. Gun control advocates were concerned that due to the coronavirus pandemic, many new gun owners were lacking the usual access to training on how to handle and store their weapons. The COVID-19 pandemic triggered a run on gun shops, as many Americans thought society might collapse. Nick Suplina, Senior Vice President of Law and Policy at Everytown for Gun Safety, a gun control nonprofit organization, said, "There were fear and real concern about what happens to the country during a global pandemic." The activist said the pro-gun lobby, National Rifle Association, NRA, fanned that fear by tweeting out a video of a woman holding a rifle and pushing firearms as a pandemic safety measure. The woman says, "You might be stockpiling up on food right now to get through this current crisis, but if you aren't preparing to defend your property when everything goes wrong, you're really just stockpiling for somebody else." According to an NORC survey, some 18% of households bought guns between March of 2020 and March of 2022. Some states have tried to impose more gun control within their own borders. Recently, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed a new law mandating criminal background checks to purchase rifles and shotguns, whereas the state previously required them only for people buying pistols. And recently, a ban on dozens of types of semi-automatic rifles cleared the Washington state legislature and is headed to the governor's desk. Other states are experiencing a new round of pressure. In conservative Tennessee, protesters descended on the state capitol to demand more gun regulation after 6 people were killed at a Nashville private elementary school last month.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.